Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Joe Turner, internationally awarded authority in computer science and education, fellow of the ACM, ABED, and CSAB, chair of the Solo Accord, vice president and chair of the publications committee of IFIP, and team chair of ABED Computing Accreditation Evaluations. Joe, you've got this sort of remarkable background. You've done so many things in your sort of history of successes, and thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Now, Joe, some time has passed since we last talked, and we've done two prior interviews. I believe this is our third. Can you share your impressions of the last two IFIP World Computing Congresses?
Well, the 2010 conference in Brisbane, which was two conferences ago, not the last one, but one before that, used a model that had been used for a while where it was basically multiple conferences running in parallel with various conferences sponsored by various IFIP technical committees. And this was sort of integrated with some overall themes. It was IFIP's 50th anniversary, so there were some special sessions around that. It was also hosted by the Australian Computer Society, and there were some Australian Computer Society events as well. So there was really a lot going on. Unfortunately, the attendance wasn't really high, and possibly because of the distance and difficulty for some people to get to Australia. There weren't many people in attendance from North America, for example. But it was a great technical success. It just wasn't viable to continue exactly like that financially. And then in 2 years later in Amsterdam in 2012, IFIP tried a quite different approach, having no submitted papers, so no research papers basically, but only invited participation, focused on a special theme that it was it hope would be of wide interest to many different people in the computing profession and government officials and policymakers and just a wide audience. Again, it was a very stimulating conference and a great success from a technical point of view, but again, the attendance was very low. Researchers, because they didn't have the opportunity to submit papers, did not attend. And so, again, there just weren't enough attendees to make it a financial success. So it's just very difficult. It's clear that the traditional IFIP model of having a large international general conference to attract a lot of people just doesn't work very well anymore. That's been fairly clear, I think, for a number of years, but IFIP has tried various ways to do things a little differently, and so far, I think there's not been a lot of success, and these conferences are not going to be successful unless they're held in a place where there's very high participation from the host country. That's the way it seems now, but again, IFIP continues to look for ways to have some sort of flagship event.
Joe, you mentioned a flagship event. I guess the World CIO Forum, which was held in something like November 2011, I think that worked fairly well. There were something like 800 CIOs around the world attending. And the conference didn't lose any money that I know of. And I believe there's a wish, isn't there, for another CIO World Conference maybe next year or the year after?
Yes, there are actually plans to do that. That conference was a success primarily, I think, because it was held in China and there was a huge attendance from Chinese citizens, and there was good support from various sources in China for the conference. And it takes that kind of support to make something like that a financial success. That level of support from government and industry sources did not materialize for either of the two previous world computer conferences. And that's been one of the problems. There have been similar problems, by the way, with another sort of major IFIP sponsored event, and that is WITFOR, the World Information Technology Forum, which is focused on information technology benefits and applications for developing countries, and it's typically held in a developing country, but again, it depends upon a lot of governmental and other kind of support external, because the registration fee is not high enough to cover all the costs of putting on the event. The first couple of WITFOR conferences were pretty successful, and they had good support from various sources, but the past two or three, that external support has dwindled quite a bit, and that is also a reason that the WITFOR has not been held as it was originally scheduled. There hasn't been one in a few years now, and the future of WITFOR is sort of in doubt as well. But the next CIO forum is scheduled again in China, and there's good support in China for that event, and so it undoubtedly will also be successful next time, and hopefully we'll build on the results of the previous conference.
So that World CIO Forum, is it going to be held next year or 2015?
Oh, you asked me an embarrassing question. I want to say 2014, but it might be 15. It has shifted a couple of times, and there was actually at one point an intermediate one scheduled in another country that didn't materialize, and so I quite honestly don't remember the exact date at this point.
So where do you see IFIP heading in a few years?
Oh, that's a good question. It's really difficult. IFIP, for those listening who aren't familiar with IFIP, IFIP is a federation of computing societies, basically one per country, sort of the United Nations model, and so IFIP doesn't have very much income. The only income from IFIP, there's some from dues, which basically just pay the cost of operating the organization, and then there is some from a little bit from conferences that are these are conferences that are sponsored by individual technical committees in special sub areas of computing, the computing field. Many of those are pretty successful, but not many of them have a lot of surplus. And then there's also some from publications. But the total budget of IFIP is just not very large, and so there's not a lot of money to invest in major activities. And IFIP's focus through the years, at least for some time now, originally there was a lot of activity around the World Computer Conference, which was pretty big at one point, and that was considered a major activity and a major thing that IFIP did. But since then, it's been on a much smaller scale and more or less trying to be a facilitator or a coordinator internationally, sort of apolitical international body that could speak for the computing profession internationally. Because the computing profession itself has typically not been very well organized, that's had, I think, varied kind of success. IFIP is recognized within various United Nations circles pretty well, but then the UN arguably is pretty variable in its effectiveness and influence as well. So bottom line is it's just really hard to say. I think there are some initiatives that IFIP might be able to do that would make a major contribution. The IP3, the International Professional Practice effort, is one example that I think has a lot of good possibilities. But Somehow, IFIP needs to break out of the old model of choosing one society from each country, and then that society having sort of exclusive rights to represent the profession within IFIP in its country. And that model has some problems, and it causes I think some attitudes or culture within IFIP that IFIP needs to advance past that level and sort of come up into the modern age a bit if good things are going to happen, or if IFIP's going to be a really influence and play a big role in the computing profession in the world.
So we're going to change directions a bit, and we're going to talk about software engineering, and there's been this sort of grassroots movement in the U.S., and where 10 states, U.S. states, have now agreed to kind of support software engineering, I guess, from an accreditation licensing standpoint. So what are your thoughts on the Software Engineering Principles and Practice Exam, or what is known as the PE exam, being finalized and this critical mass of 10 states being achieved in the U.S.? What are your thoughts about the future of software engineering and how it's going to progress?
I think it's interesting that you called it a grassroots effort. First, it's been pretty clear this was probably going to happen, since their efforts to establish licensing for software engineering began, I think, about 15 years ago in the U.S. But there's been a lot of resistance, so that's why I made the comment that I did about not clear at the grassroots effort. There's certainly a lot of opposition at the grassroots level among practitioners and academics alike. Some people, I think, feel that the field is not mature enough for licensing or for establishing a generally accepted body of knowledge or body of practice and those kind of things. And some people feel that establishing some sort of licensing process that's based on a set of principles or practices would inhibit, in fact, the rapid advances that have been happening in software engineering and throughout the computing professions, perhaps with some justification. But I do think that overall it's a good trend, and it may be beneficial in establishing computing as a profession. We should point out or recognize, though, that this PE exam, professional engineering exam, applies only to engineering and computing. That would be software engineering, and also there's one for computer engineering. But other areas, typically called computer science, information systems, information technology, those kind of academic qualifications, at least, do not apply as far as any sort of qualification for taking the software engineering PE exam. Although there are other ways to qualify to take the exam, but the most direct route is through graduation from an accredited program in an approved engineering area. So, as I said, I think it's a trend that will spread. I think there's a good chance that it will help establish at least the view, more of a generally accepted view of computing in general as a profession. Whether or not licensing itself will expand to other areas is difficult to say. In the U.S., as I think most people know, that licensing is a state-by-state matter, and every state has its own rules and what needs to be licensed and what doesn't and how you go about doing it. So such a system like that, it takes a long, long time to have significant change as far as the number of states or what states require licensing and what states do not. Kind of a rambling answer to your question, Stephen, but I think that covers a lot of general thoughts. I think it remains to be seen where it's all going to go. I think it's a good thing to be thinking about and to be wondering or to be asking whether or not we need something like this. Certainly, there's no doubt that there needs to be more discipline in especially the software side of computing professional activities. We know a lot about good practices and appropriate practices and levels of rigor and that should be applied, codes of conduct, ethical and professional. And so those things have evolved, I think, to a state where it's appropriate to begin working toward more rigor applied to establishing and enforcing and using some of these best practices and codes of professional ethical conduct.
Now, I guess I should mention for the benefit of the audience, and Joel, you can make corrections if I can summarize sort of the path to licensing, and that is that a person graduates from high school, they enter an accredited software engineering program, they graduate after 4 years, they run a fundamentals exam at that time, and then they enter a period of professional practice of a minimum 4 years, maybe 6 years or more, at which point they can then decide to write the principles of practice exam or professional engineering exam. And once passing that and getting all the sort of necessary sign-offs and other people sponsoring them, they then are licensed. I think that's the path. Am I correct, or is there some sort of modifications to
that's
that?
That's the general path. As I said, different states might have some variations on that, but that is the general path, yes.
Now, Joe, you are a noted leader in accreditations, and so this question is about how your work is progressing in accreditation.
It's progressing very well. I'm involved with two organizations that are very much involved in accreditation. That is ABET, which is the U.S. Organization for Accreditation of Undergraduate and Graduate, for that matter, Accreditation for Academic Programs in Applied Science, Computing, Engineering, and Engineering Technology. And then the Sole Accord being a mutual recognition agreement among several international accreditation organizations, similar to ABET in different countries. ABET has seen a huge increase recently in interest from outside the United States in programs at various universities outside the United States, mostly, almost exclusively, I would say, in countries that do not have an accreditation organization that accredits undergraduate programs in the technical areas, computing and engineering and engineering technology. The growth rate is of some concern to ABET, in fact, because it's potentially unsustainable, in that ABET has limited resources and a limited number of volunteers to carry out the accreditation activities, and it's not clear how if the increase continues at the current rate, it may be difficult to actually accommodate all the requests. Additionally, ABET primarily, I think, because of the increase in the interest outside the U.S. and the difficulty for people who are not familiar with either U.S. culture or the way universities operate in the U.S. And in addition, of course, to in many cases not being native English speakers, since all the ABET requirements and procedures and so forth are naturally written in English, it's very difficult for many non-English speaking institutions and programs in non-English speaking countries to get really understand what is required or what the statements of the criteria for accreditation, what they really mean. And so ABET has increasingly had to increase the number of workshops and seminars and symposia that are designed to provide a lot of this information to programs that are not accredited and who are thinking about seeking accreditation. And then also the ABET Foundation has been established, which is independent from ABET and totally not involved in ABET accreditation activities. No influence, no involvement. But the foundation is primarily provides consultants who are experts, but again have no influence in ABET accreditation decisions, but who can go and work with individual programs to help them prepare and understand the requirements so they can better prepare and know what to expect when there is an actual review by an ABET review team. So that's a big activity within ABET, and I think some other members of the Seoul Accord, for example, are experiencing some of the same kind of increase in request or interest from programs, not just in developing countries, but as I said, in any country that doesn't have its own accreditation organization. They look to accreditation as both a yardstick to measure how well they're doing and also as a validation of their ability to produce graduates who are prepared to for entry-level professional positions in one of the areas that's accredited, engineering or computing, or one of the other areas. So a lot of things going on, a lot of interest, and a lot of activity,
Now, you mentioned the Seoul Accord, and you talked about what's happening with some of the members of the Seoul Accord. Do you then see sort of rapid expansion of the membership within the Seoul Accord within the next 5 years?
Well, of course, we would hope so. As I mentioned, the Seoul Accord is what's called a mutual recognition agreement. What that means is the agreement basically says that all of the members of the Seoul Accord have examined the requirements and the processes of the other members, and all members agree to promote the accreditation processes of the other members as being substantially equivalent to their own in terms of preparing the graduates of accredited programs for as entry-level professionals. So that's basically what the agreement says. We agree that we will tell the world that they should treat graduates of your accredited programs the same as they would treat graduates of our accredited programs. Right now the Seoul Accord has 8 members, fairly small, but then we're only about 4 years or so old. I guess it's coming up on 5 now, but we do have about 8 more organizations that have expressed an intent to eventually become members. In many cases, they're relatively new accrediting organizations and need to first get their processes established, and in some cases, in some countries, it needs enabling legislation and miscellaneous things like that. So it's not a matter that you know they can just join. There is a process, and before any new member can be accepted, there has to be a review and a visit and observing the accreditation process. And by the way, that also happens for the regular members of the Accord. just as academic programs have to be reaccredited every several years, typically 6 to 10, the members of the Accord have to be essentially reaccepted into the Accord every 6 years. And so there's a review process, continuous review process that goes on by which each member of the Accord is reviewed again by a team of members, a team of representatives from some of the other Accords who present a report to the Accord during an Accord meeting, and the Accord votes whether or not to basically reaccept the individual members that were just reviewed. So it's quite an extensive process, and it's something that's taken very seriously. It's not just a matter of simply signing up and everybody says, "Oh yeah, come on in." It's quite a process to get in and to maintain the membership in the Accord.
Now, can you name some of the countries involved? For example, I know Canada is, and can you name some of the others?
Yes. I might say, for a starter, that actually the Seoul Accord is different from some other accords in other fields. The Seoul Accord applies to the computing disciplines, not software engineering or computer engineering, but the non-engineering computing areas, typically things like, as I mentioned a while ago, computer science and information systems, those kind of programs. As I was saying, the Accord, the members of the Accord are accreditation organizations, not countries. So it's not restricted, for example, to one per country, although in practice, it's expected that will probably always be that way. But, it just, in general, we saw no reason if some country wanted to have more than one valid accreditation organization, then there's no reason, if we examine them and find their processes and requirements to be substantially equivalent to everybody else's, there's no reason not to have more than one. But in any case, the countries that are currently represented are Canada, as you said, and the UK, Japan, Australia, South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and the United States. And let's see, did I miss anybody? Is that eight? I think that's everybody. There are eight of them, and those are the eight. You know. I wouldn't want to mention any of those who have committed to likely membership in the future.
You know, it's interesting. I was a speaker at the two economic forums, and especially in the IT area, in Astana, which is in the Russian-speaking countries. It's the largest Eurasian economic forum. And I spoke about the Seoul Accord, and I was surprised that so few people were aware of it. So is there a program to sort of educate different communities around the world about the Seoul Accord?
There's no formal program. basically, the Accord has been occupied so far. We're just getting its house in order, so to speak, getting an established secretariat and practices just to keep all these processes going, to agree on rules and procedures. There are some naturally sticky issues, such as what happens or what is the agreement relative to cases where a Accord member accredits programs outside its own home jurisdiction, so to speak, home country, and what processes should be followed, and so there are just some differences there that you would expect when you have people from different cultures and from political environments that in some cases are fairly rigid and fairly, let's say, top-down oriented, and then you have environments in other countries where there is a lot more sort of freedom or distribution of control or management on such things as accreditation and licensure and so on. So resolving all of these issues and managing the concerns of very small organizations that operate in the same organization, the same umbrella, that is the Solo Accord, as very, very large organizations, it's the same sort of thing you find, of course, in places like the United Nations. They're just different interests. And in IFIP, too, for that matter. I mean, IFIP, you know, has members, very, very large, powerful, in some sense, societies that are members, whose budgets dwarf IFIP's own budget. And then you have, on the other hand, member organizations of IFIP that can barely afford or have difficulty paying a token membership dues of 200 or 400 euros a year. So anytime you have that mix of interest and focus among different constituents, there naturally will be some differences of opinion on, especially on matters having to do with things like, as I mentioned, accreditation outside the home country and how that should be treated. So the accord that you started off saying, is there any program to make the accord better known? And the short answer is no. We've been too involved in trying to get some of these fundamental issues involved. Because if you don't get those kind of issues involved early on, then they will cause much bigger problems later on. And we've actually seen that happen. We've been able to profit from some of the experiences of other accords that have faced similar issues and not gotten them resolved until the problem surfaced. And so we're very anxious to get that all settled. But then again, the accord doesn't have a whole lot of money, so there's not a lot of money to be put into trying to provide such education. We do discuss at IFIP meetings. We're not formally a part of IFIP, but quite often the accord makes a brief report, and we remind all the members of IFIP that the accord exists and urge them to make it known in their home country. But then again, that's not a particularly effective way to reach a lot of people. And it's difficult to, you know, how do you reach a lot of people? You know, your experience is in one small part of the world. How many different small parts of the world can you do the sort of thing that you did, and where's the money going to come from to pay the expenses of somebody to travel around to various places and try to do these promotional activities? So I'm not trying to make excuses, of course. I'm just saying it's a difficult thing. It just takes time. It takes time. I think the main thing that the accord needs to try to do is to grow, because once the membership gets up into the, say, 15 to 20 size, and you have 15 to 20 different countries involved, then naturally the accord will, without doing anything, become much better known, because it will be essentially known within a larger number of countries.
Well, it sounds like within the next maybe 10 years, you're going to reach that critical mass, and it's going to continue to sort of self-expand then, in a sense, because of that base being met. Now I'm going to sort of go into another sort of broader question, and you've got an incredible educational background, and you've won or been recognized and won awards in this area, and that's education. Can you talk about what you believe, from your perspective, is noteworthy in education today and into the future?
This may apply more to computing education, which is what I'm most familiar with. But I mean, Without a doubt, I think the biggest hot topic today, or hot button, is so-called MOOCs, or the massive open online courses. The whole issue of online versus what might be called a more traditional or brick-and-mortar kind of education is a very big topic, a big issue. It's been a clear trend for many years now, and somehow seems to have exploded over the past 2 or 3 years with these massive online courses that anybody can take. And I can recall back when online offerings started, I mean, people have been doing different kind of distance education for quite some time, and the trend in organizations, many of them for-profit organizations, the trend of institutions, organizations that offer distance education has been more toward using technology and online capabilities of various kinds, and there's been a lot of experience doing that. There's also been a trend, of course, with regular universities over the years offering more and more sort of individual online courses. A few have even offered, mostly at the master's level, say, online full degree programs. And many people, like a lot of other things that have come along, that we're going to change the world or save the world or whatever, didn't live up to the promise. You had a lot of politicians who thought that online was going to be the answer and it was going to solve all the economic problems and make education available to everybody, and faculty members could just start teaching hundreds and hundreds of students online, and it was very easy, and all you had to do was either just tape or film your lectures and put them online, and then students would magically learn. And, you know, of course, none of that worked out. And those of us who tried, who did some of it, I didn't do a whole lot. I did a little bit of online. I had one course that was basically available online if students wanted to take it that way. And, you know, a lot of things become very quickly apparent, and a lot of those lessons were forgotten. And one is that, like normal regular education, different students learn in different ways. Different things work for some students and they don't work for others. It takes a lot of self-motivation and self-discipline to do a course online. And so these massive courses, these MOOCs, naturally have experienced huge numbers of students signing up and not very many finishing in many cases, and which is not at all surprising, but somehow the media, of course, immediately picks up on that, and a lot of critics pick up on that and say, well, they're doomed to failure. Obviously, they have, this isn't working. But anything new like that is going to have growing problems. So I think it's very much up in the air at this point. The role of online work or non-traditional based work is not clear. I am one who believes that there will always be a place and a value in a traditionally oriented kind of education where you have a mentor, not a traditional in the sense of a traditional lecture, but very big trend, and I think a very important and valuable trend over the past 10 to 20 years has been moving away from the teacher as a pronouncer or a distributor of knowledge to a more of a mentor guidance role. And you have things like what's called a flipped kind of organization in courses where mostly the what used to be traditional lecture part or discussion part or explanation part is put online and available to students, and they're expected when they come to class to already have used that, viewed that, and studied it and thought about it. And then the in-class activities are more hands-on, working in small groups with the teacher as a mentor for guidance and a lot more individual attention. And that's working very, very well, especially for some students. It works very, very well. So the biggest question in my mind is, where is all this going, and where is it all going to end up? And hopefully it won't just go away too quickly. You know, we have many instances, some not even related to education. For one that comes to mind, for example, is in computer science in particular. I'm sure everyone's heard of artificial intelligence. And when artificial intelligence first started becoming prominent, this was back in the 70s, at least that long ago, and it was pronounced as artificial intelligence was basically going to solve all the problems, and computers would be smart, they'd be able to do natural languages and solve problems by themselves, and this was just going to happen within a very short period of time. Some people were saying 5 or 10 years. Well, of course it didn't happen. I mean, it's like any, like many things that are new, it was overpromised and just didn't work. So then everybody gave up on it. It says, "Oh, this is no good. This will never go anywhere. It's just an academic exercise." And of course, as we all know, I mean, we have voice recognition systems all over the place today. We have natural text translation systems that work fairly well and are getting better all the time. And so the point is, many of these problems are very, very hard, and they don't have very, very simple solutions at all. And we have to be patient, and we have to recognize there will be some failures. It's very rare that we have significant successes without some stumbling along the way, and the corrections have to be made. And so the key is to sort of hang in there and be patient and take advantage of the lessons that we learn and work toward continuous improvement, which is something we should do in almost every activity we have.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, my perspective as a Canadian is that the U.S. experience of online education is very different from, let's say, the U.K. experience or the Canadian experience, in that there are recognized accredited programs in the UK, in the US, in fact, or I should say in Canada, many of the Commonwealth countries, where online education is considered sort of equivalent or on par in many respects to sort of traditional education. My feeling is, just from my American colleagues, is that it's not the same in the US. So it's interesting. I just chaired the Global Industry Council meeting last week, and one of the participants, one of the members of Global Industry Council, is the Director of Technology for the Commonwealth of Learning, which represents the ministries of education of over 50 countries. And he announced during the meeting that IIT, the India Institute of Technology, a very prestigious organization in India, is now offering MOOCs where they're anticipating tens of thousands of students to enroll in their first courses to be offered shortly, and they're going to offer proctored exams at different testing centers. But the courses are free. And the reason they're doing this is to kind of address the shortage they're feeling in the skills area in that country. But it's interesting how they're embracing this idea. And yet, I think it's a controversial idea. Or, you know, you have edX, this consortium founded by MIT and Harvard, which has, I believe, something like 12 universities involved and nearly 700,000 students, or Coursera, which is offering free courses from now over 60 universities, and they have something like close to 3 million students. And I guess it all started with Stanford when they offered this artificial intelligence course to 160,000 students in 190 countries. And I think 20,000 did complete the course, or some, maybe a little bit over 20,000. But what happened was the social media volunteer translators made it available in 44 languages. And maybe the foundation of all of this is the Khan Academy, you know, where they've got over 3,000 micro video lectures on YouTube and over, something like, what, over 200 million lessons delivered. So I think there's controversy, and maybe the U.S. experience is a little bit more controversial than maybe some of the other countries out there.
Well, yeah, and I did, although I'm not sure the U.S. experience is any less than in many other countries. But there's certainly been many successes in the U.S. I think what remains to be seen is I think what is the proper balance. I mean, there's certainly many successful and perfectly fine. There's some for example, APED has accredited online programs. Those programs should be recognized just as the same way any other accredited program would be recognized. So it may not be quite as widespread in the U.S. I don't have a good feel for that, but certainly there are many successes, and there have been some successes with these MOOCs, massive online courses. What I was saying is that I think we have to be careful about jumping to conclusions too quickly, and it's important it's important that we be patient and that we learn from the past, which I don't think has always been done. As I said earlier, I certainly could have predicted many of the problems that I've seen people act surprised about, just on the basis of my very limited experience. And many of these things have been published and talked about in places like, the ACM SIGSE conference, which is the computer science education, special interest group. Many of these things that happen with online, when you try to do online or certain kinds of distance education activities, are pretty well known and documented. And so the key is to find ways to use these capabilities that technology enables, to use them in the most effective way. And that's not any different from figuring out how to most effectively use the traditional classroom setting. As I said a while ago, you know, we learned quite some time ago that a traditional lecture model where the teacher pontificates for some period of time and then the students go away and maybe do a few exercises or something on their own, that model doesn't work very well for a large segment of the population. So that's been addressed.
Joe, we're going to switch gears again, and this is for our last few questions, and I know you've got to go pretty soon. So can you share your thoughts on the ACM? I know you've been a strong and long contributor to this very dominant, sort of predominant society. So can you talk about your thoughts on the ACM?
Sure. The ACM is doing very well. And to make just a short statement, the membership is growing. There are many strong major conferences in various areas. A highly respected and successful digital library for competing literature, and many prestigious journals. The branches in Europe and China and India are growing, developing very well. And the membership, I think it's up around 40% outside North America now. So ACM is really truly becoming, or has become, a prominent major international, in some respects, competing organization for competing professionals. Again, to contrast that a bit with IFIP, I don't think it's fair to even compare the organizations. ACM is an organization of individual members, and IFIP is an organization of organizations. So one reason I think that ACM has been very successful and is making such major contributions in areas such as education, at education at many different levels, they see them finances are in pretty good shape because of the large membership and the very successful publications and conferences that that ACM has. So one, ACM has not tried to be all things to all people, and has, for example, very large and influential, important computing society that is based in the U.S., but also has about the same or roughly same percentage, I think, of non-U.S. members as ACM does, and that's the IEEE Computer Society. So the two organizations do cooperate, I think, very well in many things, most notably in education, where there's a lot of cooperation. ACM doesn't do anything in the standards area, for example, because the Computer Society has always been involved in that. And ACM has also not gotten involved heavily with things like professional certification, other than being a member of the ICCP, the International Professional Certification Organization in Computing. And so I think the two organizations really complement each other very well in many respects. But the short answer to the question is, I think ACM is doing very well, and it's good to see ACM doing a lot of activities that it has the ability to do, simply for one reason, because it's in reasonable financial shape.
So, Joel, we're down to our last question, and this is about IFIP IP3. You did mention IP3 before. So what are your views on IFIP IP3, which is working to have computing as a recognized profession on par with, let's say, accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
When I mentioned it before, it was, having to do with IFIP and the things that IFIP might be able to do, and I mentioned that the IP3 project I thought was one example of a good kind of activity that it's appropriate for an organization like IFIP to undertake. The IP3, International Professional Practice Group, subgroup of IFIP, I think is making great strides, although, again, as you well know, since you've been involved with it yourself, there are a lot of people who don't know anything about IP3 and who maybe don't appreciate the importance of such an organization. And even if they do, it just takes a very, very long time to make significant progress in having people adopt or understand the importance of establishing things like codes of conduct and best practice and rigorous procedures for validation and other aspects of software and other technology implementation. And so, again, very, very short to say it very succinctly, I think what IP3 is trying to do is great. However, it's a very, very difficult task to undertake. And again, I think we have to be patient and recognize that it is going to take some time. Hopefully, more and more of the large software-oriented industries will get on board and promote and support these kind of efforts, and perhaps more organizations as well. So hopefully that will happen. It takes a long time to establish a profession, but it's important work, And I think it's important that we stay the course and continue working on that.
Well, Joe, I know you have to, in fact, you're maybe leaving a little bit late for your next appointment, so I'm going to close it off here and just thank you for coming in today. I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. And again, we appreciate you sharing your many deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you, Stephen. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Joe Turner, internationally awarded authority in computing science and education, fellow of the ACM, ABET, CSAB, chair of the SoloCord, vice president and chair of the publications committee of IFIP, and team chair for ABET Computing Accreditation Evaluations.